This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The NFL football team in Washington, D.C. was in the news a lot last year, not because of their record, but because of their name, Washington Redskins. Many in the American Indian community have spoken out against the use of racial slurs and stereotypes for team mascots, and they're using social media and the internet to do it. Native scholars and activists gathered last week at UNC's third annual Native Leaders Symposium. They talked about the mascot debate and other issues that surround representations of American Indians and their cultures. We continue that conversation today on The State of Things with Liz Ellis. She's a citizen of the Peoria Tribe of Indians in Oklahoma, co-president of UNC's First Nations Graduate Circle. Liz organized the Native Leaders Symposium and is with us. Liz, thanks for joining us. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us, Adrienne Keene, a Cherokee scholar and writer. Her blog, Native Appropriations, has become a popular read for American Indians and non-natives alike. Adrienne spoke at the symposium last Friday and joins us now from a studio at Brown University, where she's president, a presidential postdoctoral fellow. Hello, Adrienne.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Liz, you organized the conference at UNC. It's called Native Leaders Symposium, and the theme was visibility and representation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it was actually me and my co-president, Brooke Bauer, and a couple of years ago, we decided we really needed an event to bring American Indian leaders onto campus. We'd both been working as teaching assistants within the history department and realized that our students were having some trouble connecting what they learned in history classes to present day, because a lot of them had gotten to college and sort of thought they'd never met a real Indian. And so we realized we needed something where the students would be able to talk to real Indian leaders and kind of have these discussions that weren't happening.
What's the first thing you find, the first kind of the characteristic that emerges from people who then meet you as their first real Indian, and now you're representing, you know, sort of all kinds of people all at once?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that. Yeah, because when you think about American Indians and you think about the image of American Indians, what comes to mind, right, are costumes, things like the Washington football team, you know, the girl on the Land O'Lakes butter. And then you meet a real Indian and you think, well, this doesn't look like, you know, what I expected you to look like. And so we sort of needed to have this discussion about, yes, Indigenous people are real, they exist in the present, and we're not all wearing leather and feathers. So. Yeah.
Well, Adrienne, you've been a voice on these issues for a long time. Yours is a voice among others. How did you tell us a little bit about how you started the blog Native Appropriations and why?
Sure. Well, I grew up in California, and I went to undergrad out at Stanford University, and Stanford has a really diverse and strong Native community. So that was kind of what student community, and that was sort of what I was used to in a college environment, was having these other Native students around, having faculty who understood that Native students existed, classmates who understood that we were their fellow students. And then I moved out to the East Coast for grad school, and suddenly I was surrounded by entire classrooms of people who, like Liz was talking about, had never met a Native person. Native issues weren't represented in the classroom. And then on top of it, it was just at the very start of the kind of big tribal trends we've been seeing in fashion in the last few years. And so something kind of clicked for me. And I realized that the only images my classmates ever saw, that my faculty ever saw, were these very stereotypical images, and that that was a problem. So I started the blog as a way, it started out as a place where I was just going to sort of collect these images and have a repository, a place where I could put them all. And it has developed into a place where we as a community can really critique these images and have a space to speak back against misrepresentations and also really celebrate the incredible things that are going on in our communities as well and create these counter representations and counter narratives to those stereotypes.
Well, and I understand that one of the things that helped clarify for you the essence of the problem was a trip to Urban Outfitters. Am I right?
Correct. That was actually my very first post on the blog. I went to Harvard University for my my doctoral work, and there's an Urban Outfitters right in Harvard Square. And that moment of it all kind of coming together was walking through the sort of bargain basement area and seeing totem pole jewelry stands and these neon dream catchers and fake moccasins and t-shirts with headdresses on it and all of these things in one place, and realizing that my classmates also walked through that store often, and that was something that was surrounding us all the time. So my very first post on the blog is called It Starts with a Trip to Urban Outfitters.
And you moved move between these poles, don't you, Liz? These kind of these mythic ideas, stereotypic ideas that are on the one hand the kind of noble savage and a kind of identification with nature and these new age ideas of dream catchers and crystals and the like. And then the other side is the what we get through the news, a kind of pathologized native cultures dealing with health outcomes and various sort of pathologies that we would describe perhaps on the reserves. And these are the two images that we are living with and not much in between.
And it's extremely, I mean, I'm glad you bring that up. It's extremely difficult to talk about issues within Indian country and to really discuss and deal with these things if you can't see native peoples. And so I think there's 122,000 people in North Carolina that identified as Native on the last census. And how on earth are you supposed to deal with problems specific to that population if they remain kind of invisible?
And those populations are complex and have done a lot of mixing over time and various levels of integration. Melinda Lowry joins us now in the studio. Melinda is a professor and director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Melinda, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Every semester you have your students work on social media or the internet. You created a project on the North Carolina Native history. One of those projects was a Lumbee History Photo Identification Project on Facebook. Could you tell us about that?
Right. So my students in our Lumbee History class in 2013 created this, what's become an incredible project, where they started a Facebook group, a closed group that we've invited people to and other people have joined since then, that was really just designed initially to put up historical photographs of Lumbee people and ask, who are these folks? So we can just get names. One of the key features of Lumbee culture is sitting down, looking at photos of your ancestors and almost ritually reciting their names and telling stories about them. And it's a way, looking at photographs is a way to feel connected to our community as a whole. As Liz said, against these stereotypes that we deal with, it's a way for us to see ourselves and also a way for us to put out kind of to the public who we are. So my students had this great idea of creating this Facebook group where people could just do that. I think there's probably more Lumbees on Facebook than any other ethnic group in America. I wouldn't be surprised. We're all over Facebook. And so now we have 4,500 members of this Facebook group who are sharing photos on a daily basis, sharing stories. A gentleman named Kelvin Oxendine, who's in the Air Force, has adopted this page as his vocation, and he's also recently published a book of photographs from the Robeson County Indian community. And it's just kind of become a fabulous way of telling our own story, totally against the kind of stereotypes that Liz and Adrian talk about.
And those stereotypes not only affect those who are not natives, but also I would think internalizing some of these stereotypes, seeing these pictures has a way of exercising those visions for people who live in those communities. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our students, whether it's in the Intro to Native American History class, which a lot of freshmen at UNC take, or it's any number of our advanced classes in American Indian Studies, usually come in kind of burdened by images, and it inhibits their learning. It actually inhibits their ability to acquire cultural competency in with a population that's different than their own. And as any professional educator will tell you, really the whole point of education is to learn to deal with folks who are different than you. And so if, especially as a public system, if we're not able to educate non-Native students about Native people today, those students are suffering and our society as a whole is suffering at not being able to fulfill an opportunity that's basic to their education.
And Liz, that raises the really difficult question about identifying with a culture or cultures and saying there is something called Native identity and yet not stereotyping. It is a complex thing. So then the question is sort of how do we define, to what extent is definition our friend and when does it become the enemy, and how do we locate those boundaries?
Absolutely. And I think there's a pretty profound difference too between an individual identifying as Native and one of these representations being pushed on them from the outside. One of the things that, I mean, Adrian has talked about extensively is representations of American Indian women and connecting the images of American Indian women, Pocahontas costumes, to sexual availability and hypersexualization of American Indian women, and just making people understand that there is a connection, a real connection between these representations and the realities which we live. And so there's sort of that external thing, and then there's internal identities.
And Adrian, of course, the question of mascots always comes up, and I wonder if you'd talk about that, because, of course, the defense is, and the disclaimer is, well, look, we're honoring these traditions. That's why we're doing this. We're sort of trying to remember our past and not lose it. I mean, that's what you'll hear is kind of part of the defense. How do you respond to all that, and how do you see us going forward in this kind of mascot controversy?
Yeah, I think the we're honoring you argument is, at this point, to me, is just absolutely ridiculous when you have thousands of Native people who are telling you to your face that, no, we're not honored by these images. And the ways that you would truly honor Native people is by, well, A, listening to our voices and listening to our needs and our desires, but also just honoring true representations of us and helping us to develop these images that are supportive of our communities, that are true portrayals, and that represent who we are as contemporary people, as your neighbors, as your classmates, as your friends, as your family, rather than these disembodied heads of stereotypical images that don't represent us in any way, shape, or form.
And then let me put the question I just put to Liz, to you, this question of how do we represent when, or try to understand when the answer to this is, it is complex, it is not all one thing, and it's not stereotype, and yet it's an identity. How should we go forward? How should we try to understand those boundaries, Adrian?
Yeah, I think what I really strive to do with the blog is just to take away what I call people's ignorance defense. And so I think a lot of people, because the only images we ever see of Native people are these very narrow stereotypes, have no idea that Native identity is complex. And so, and that there are 566 federally recognized tribes and hundreds more state and non-federally recognized tribes, and that each of us have our own language, our own history, our own culture, our own practices, our own art, whatever it is. And so by doing this work of creating exposure around issues of representation, we're taking away folks' ignorance defense so they can no longer say, oh, I had no idea. And so it's about starting that conversation. It's about creating what I call a moment of pause. So when people are looking at these representations, rather than just taking it as the status quo and seeing it as something normalized, they're going to pause for a moment and maybe start to think about it and start to question it. So I don't want people to formulate a new idea of a sort of one-sided Native, contemporary Native identity. I want them to understand that Native identity is complex and multifaceted, and that each tribe or each community has its own culture and identity, and that needs to be respected.
We are talking about Native appropriations and Native identities today on The State of Things. One of my guests, Adrian Keene, a writer and the author of the Native Appropriations blog. Melinda Lowry is with us, a professor at UNC, and Liz Ellis is a PhD student at the University of North Carolina. Liz, you were about to respond to some of that, too.
Well, so, and I think this discussion of culture and identity is extremely important, but I think that the other key factor here is that American Indian nations are sovereign nations today. And so much like you might identify as German or Lithuanian or anything else, to be American Indian is in part an issue of sovereignty and nationhood. So there are layers with the culture.
It's a political identity, and we don't expect Lithuanians or Germans to live their lives unchanged or in some homogenous fashion. But we do ask that of American Indians for whatever reason, because we're almost willfully ignorant of the complexity. And that's why what Adrian is doing is so important, because she's trying to remind people that identity is not one single experience, and why are we holding American Indians to a different standard than we do anybody else?
And that's why you're using multi-platform digital expression is important. And I understand that UNC Pembroke has taken on some of the digital ideas as well.
Yes. So the School of Southeastern American Indian Studies at UNC Pembroke is in the early stages of launching a digital archive project that they've been collaborating with us at UNC on. They are also going to be a site in our Wikipedia edit-a-thon tomorrow night, which is going to be at Wilson Library at 5 p.m. In Chapel Hill, and then also a site at UNC Pembroke will be open to for folks to come and edit the Wikipedia pages that exist on North Carolina American Indians and create new pages where none exist. So those types of collaborations are really important for us being able to, you know, re-educate the public.
Well, and we get back to this idea of what the danger and some of the sorrow caused by internalizing these, and by, I think, these collaborative projects in a lot of ways allow people to investigate in a much more complex and nuanced way their own Indianness. I mean, am I right about that? Is that something that allows you to have this conversation within the communities?
Yeah, I think within the communities, especially across generations, as economies, politics, lifestyles change, you know, each generation has its own notion of what it means to be Indian. And the more that Facebook, for example, or any other kind of social media platform can be used to connect people who have different experiences of what it means to be Indian, the more robust and kind of healthy our communities are going to be, the less likely our young people in particular are going to be to absorb these kinds of negative images, or even, as you said, the super positive images, the oversimplified images. The less likely they're going to be to absorb those oversimplified images, and the more likely they're going to be to embrace their own complexity and carry that forward as a strength.
Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Melinda Lowry is a professor of oral history at UNC Chapel Hill. Liz Ellis is a history PhD student at that same institution and co-president of UNC's First Nations Graduate Circle. Adrian Keene is a postdoctoral fellow at Brown University and the creator of Native Appropriations. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can see links to all of the blogs and the projects that we've talked about in today's program at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.